team on paper on FUBAR Radio.
For you lucky people out there who are listening to the podcast, this is an extra bit.
Extra
of good time. Good time on paper. Good team on
it's
paper.
It's good times. It's good times. It's extra times.
Good time on paper, the show about prostitutes.
Angus Locker, it's an absolute pleasure to still have you here for this extra bit. I've got to ask you, as a man who's been to see so many great games, and you've given us wonderful moments for that, what would you say the best goals are that you've ever seen?
Can I just ask, before you answer that, roughly how many games do you think you've been to? To the nearest 100?
Oh, to the nearest 100 would be hard, but it's a few thousand.
Wow.
It is a few thousand. I shouldn't know exactly, but I couldn't tell you exactly, but it's a few thousand.
We're comfortable funny, with you not knowing exactly.
It's funny that you mentioned extra time, because I think right up there, I mean, if you had to name, say half a dozen great goals, I mean, they're in extra time, that Ryan Giggs goal in the semi-final for Manchester United against Arsenal in 99 is right up there with the best I've seen live. I was lucky enough to be there, and it was an extraordinary goal that started from, Vieira giving the ball away, and then he just kept running. I remember having the chance to interview Alex Ferguson prior to the final that year, and I asked him what he remembered of the game, and he gave me a great line. He just carried on talking, and when I put it to the pictures, it actually fitted the actual run to the absolute moment.
Wow,
so he obviously remembered it exactly, but it was a pivotal moment for him, and as a great goal, that was one of the best. I went to Stamford Bridge and saw an end-of-season clash when Newcastle were going well to try and get the Champions League, and Cisse scored a goal right in front of where I've never seen anyone try and bend it. I remember watching Manchester United seeing Justin Fashanu many years ago do it, but to actually see it live and the way that the ball curved and went round, Cisse's goal would definitely...
Oh. Sorry, when you said it earlier, I was thinking Gibril, but you're talking Papiss, aren't
you? Papiss,
yeah,
Papiss, Cisse.
He was unstoppable for about 3 months.
Funnily enough, the others, I was at Hampden when Zidane got that wonderful volley.
Saw that?
Yeah, I was in the stadium for
that's
that.
That's been a role,
And another amazing goal, which I think, the game will be remembered for an amazing goal, but I actually remember the game for another goal in the game. In a European final, Arsenal played Zaragoza at Parc des Princes, and Naeem scored from the halfway line. Mm-hmm. But that's what the fans always sing. But there was an amazing goal in that game by S. Snyder for Zaragoza. It was sort of like the same, similar to Zidane's. It just the technique was amazing, and I'd have to have that on my shortlist. I also remember a goal in the UEFA Cup final, which I went to, involving Juventus, where Juventus played Parma in Milan, and Viali scored a goal. And it came over his head, and I had a great view of it. It was one bounce, run, volley, goal. And it reminded me of of another semi-final great goal that Manchester United scored, actually too dissimilar in event, also against Arsenal, and people were sort of on about Giggs's goal, but Norman Whiteside scored a goal in the semi-final against Arsenal in an amazing semi-final where they won 2-1, having been behind. Arsenal were leading, and then Brian Robson got an equaliser, but it was the winner from Whiteside that I'll always remember as being... one of the great goals. And then, I have seen some amazing goals all round at different levels, but I think if you wanted a list, I'd be happy with that list.
Incredible. Wow. If we could just see
and they're
one
the ones
those.
I've been in the stadium for.
That's incredible. What a history. We were going to... we saw the news today about Van Gaal retiring. Obviously, you've seen so many of the Man United games and sat behind him quite a few times.
I actually got very close to Van Gaal. I was very fortunate in the 90s to have a job commentating on the Dutch football for an American television network. And between 92 and 2000, I probably saw Ajax 300 times.
Oh, wow.
But in those 2 years that they dominated, well, they won the Champions League in 95 and then got to the final again in 96.
Oh, I have to ask. Who was better, Young Bergkamp or Young Ibrahimovic?
Oh, I think Young Bergkamp. I was lucky. I mean, Ibrahimovic has matured into being a superb footballer. He's a bit arrogant in a lot of ways, but he does a lot off the field. Bergkamp was just something special. I mean, the Ajax era that I watched them, they were a particularly good side, and you just knew players were going. I think if one or two look back, they Nick Martin should have come to the Premier League a lot earlier than he did. And he did well at Liverpool, but he wasn't a sensation there. Mm. He'd have been a sensation if he'd gone there at the same time.
Remembered so well, though.
Yeah, I mean, you looked at... I mean, probably the most interesting player I think I've ever seen was Seedorf, because I'm not sure about his age. I don't believe it.
67.
I saw his
He's still 34, isn't he?
I saw his debut, and, I was lucky. I saw Ronaldo, the Brazilian Ronaldo's debut. Yeah.
The real Ronaldo, we call him.
I went to a game, first game of the season, Vitesse against PSV, and Ronaldo came on, and just I thought, we've seen a proper player here. And, what he went on to achieve, he was an exciting player, he was dynamic. And
if he hadn't had those injuries.
But Romario, PSV have had some extraordinary players. I mean, you look back over the years and you see some of the strikers that they've had. They've had Van Nistelrooy, they've had Ronaldo, and they've had Romario.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I know Southampton have brought up some great players over the years, but PSV were quite interesting. But in those days, so 95, 96, I mean, Ajax had a bloody good side. I mean, there was everyone playing for them, really. I mean, Patrick Kluivert came on. He came on. I saw his debut was as a sub. It was quite ironic because his son came on to play for Ajax last week. So maybe that aged me a bit. But I was thinking, well, I saw your debut, his dad's debut. But it's a bit like with Danny Blint and Daley Blint. I mean, and by the way, Daley Blint's father, Danny Blint, was an iconic captain for Ajax. He was
top player.
Yeah, so Van Gaal's in charge. And it went for him in the early part when he won the UEFA Cup. But he got this team... He got his team to play superbly. In fact, one of the best team performances I ever saw was when they went to the Bernabeu and Real Madrid had a good side, and they won the game 2-0, but they played really well. And I mean, I just thought that it was a big shame that Van Gaal clearly had a more attacking view to football than he showed at Old Trafford. But when he had that Ajax team with the likes of... I mean, Overmars was a sensational player. We saw that when he came to Arsenal, and he came. But, I mean, the likes of... They had Overmars on one side. They had Fanini, who was a great Nigerian international. They had Frank de Boer in the middle, who was great. I mean, Rijkaard was towards the end of his career, but what a player he was. Then they had, Bergkamp. They had, Vichka had just finished. They had, really good players. Ronald Frank de Boer, as I mentioned, Bergkamp. But I like Lip Marlin. I thought he was, at the time, I thought he was a clever player. He was quick. He was agile. He was, and
hell of a finish.
Well,
double meaning, guys.
Yeah, we got you on that one.
You've been slammed. Burn.
If only we could film the withering look.
It's being filmed.
Oh, it is being filmed. We got the withering look.
But Van Gaal, he got some negative feedback for his time in Germany, and I mean, it didn't sort of work out for one reason or another at Barcelona, and I mean, as Dutch coach. He'll obviously still be remembered for. Funny enough, it was an interesting day because I didn't go to England. It was a day England. People will always remember the day England beat Germany 5-1. Yeah. Well, I went that day to Lansdowne Road and saw Van Gaal have one of his low moments of his career as Ireland qualified for the World Cup, beating the Dutch, and extraordinary afternoon both ways, really.
What would you say went wrong for him at Man United?
I think he was too negative. And I think he was too afraid to lose. And I think it was a great shame because he wasn't afraid to give youngsters a chance. Absolutely not. He was very happy to bring in... I mean, Rashford's a classic example. Mm. I mean, there have been other youngsters who haven't quite made it, but he wasn't afraid to give them a chance. I think he'd had a few personal issues that were hurting him, and like we've learned recently that he's quitting the game. Yeah. He won't be remembered with that much affection by the way that he played by the Manchester United supporters. I mean, for me, it's a completely different issue because I think he's a fantastic coach and a good manager, and he's humorous, and he's a great man, Van Gaal. I just think that he didn't have to play the way he did. He was too scared to lose. And that's he's not the gambler that Ferguson was. Alex Ferguson wasn't scared to lose. Alex Ferguson didn't want the match to end 0-0. He'd throw gun high. That's why there were too many scoreless draws. And the United fans, I mean, I know some people who say sit in the cage, stand behind the goal, who went 9 games without seeing a goal at their end of the ground. Well, I mean, that's not Manchester United. No. Not even a shot on target.
It's not it was
almost like that he'd gone into a recluse mode and it was too negative. And really, he did very well to stay in the job after the defeat of the week that they had against Wolfsburg and Bournemouth. And that's when it should all have finished. I thought it was a bit cruel the way that the club tanged him on. And then, I mean, it was a fantastic win to win the FA Cup. But he loses his job 2 days later. And in all intents and purposes, he'd lost his job before. I think the way that they treated him was poor.
He kept his
humility, and I think that when you look back on it, that you've got to hand it to the man to control himself, because that was not a way to treat a human being.
Do you not think, though, that it was an element of the Brian Clough at Nottingham Forest, where basically David Moyes was the rebound manager, and they never backed him, and
well, it goes
and
back
he,
then
he was
to
doomed to failure regardless.
I know where you're coming from, but I'd take a better example with the same club. It was what happened after Matt Busby. Manchester United appointed Franco Farrell, and that was never going to work. And basically, David Moyes had the Franco Farrell role. And then it was what came after that. United were in turmoil.
Because Ferguson's last team to win the Premier League were, I think, the worst team to win the Premier League.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was dreadful. Honestly believe that he would have gone the year before and they ended up surprising City on that last day when Aguero scored the amazing goal against QPR to give him the title. I think that the following year, he just decided to have another year only because he wanted to get the title back. And I think his focus right from the word go, the United's title plans for the next season started 10 seconds probably after the final whistle at Sunderland. I think he just said, look, I'm going to have it one more go. You could almost tell that season something was going on. I never read it quickly enough because they got beaten by Real Madrid, and you knew that night just his reaction was, it wasn't just losing to Real Madrid, it was his last European night at United, but his sole intention that season was to win the league, and he did it. And he'll be remembered, but he didn't leave. I think Moyes' mistake, I'll tell you what Moyes' mistake was. He should have, the moment he was manager, he should have walked in the door and taken control. He shouldn't have said, I'm waiting to the 1st of July. That was a big, big error. He let May, June and the early part of July go. He hadn't got his infrastructure right. He should have kept a few people from the infrastructure of Ferguson alive. He could have had Mike Phelan doing all the groundwork for him. No one. It would have been a change that would have almost been, and gradually bringing his own people.
Do you think keeping Ryan Giggs was a good move?
Yeah, absolutely, because I think he could have had, he wanted someone from the old guard. I don't think Giggs was a problem at all. Had no issue with that at all. But where you did have an issue was, it was almost like the whole of the rest of backstop out, and he didn't need to do that. He could have just done it gradually. He could have made his own way by finding things out.
Club
about
like
the club.
Man United, you could bring everyone in.
Yeah, he can do whatever he wants.
Can have more work together.
But where he made his mistake is, I don't think he quite realised what a big job he was walking into. And I think, okay, fine, there was to do. He should have just gone the day he was appointed. I'm in now. I'm not waiting.
Yeah.
And he gave them a massive head start.
I think I almost saw one of them having to do, even though he's remembered really unfavourably, a kind of a Graham Souness job, would make a better job of it, almost demolish.
What? The break people's legs?
When he was manager of Liverpool. Like, although that would be a great start. Moyes just coming in, sliding straight into the first person he sees. But
Bebe, I don't like you.
That's straight out. I just mean if you either decide to keep with the culture of the club and the structure, or you destroy it completely. And I think kind of...
Well, yeah, but you still go in on the first day to start it. You don't mess people about, and you don't give people and keep them in limbo, and you don't stay away and leave Manchester United without an identity for 8-10 weeks, which is not how that club works.
And Brian Clough illustrated what happens when you just try and destroy a club's culture overnight. You last 44 days.
Yeah, that's true. This is a.
But Brian Clough's famous for being quoted as saying that, you know, when he was asked about the England manager, he said the FA knew that that if they appointed me, I'd sack the lot of them, and you know what, I would have done exactly that. So I mean, he was a maverick. He was a one-off, and I mean, you know, would he have worked for England? Who knows? Yeah. But there weren't too many like Clough.
Can we ask you a bit about fantasy football?
Yeah,
the show that made, I think, basically it popularised the game.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't ripped off any of the part of it for this show at all.
Allegedly.
With a news roundup from a statistician.
Maybe a bit about your personal background as well. How did you get into it? What's your...
Well, I think the fantasy football's a good format. I mean, it worked. Frank and David are two outstanding, basically they came up with the idea. I mean, originally I think they were looking to have a sort of like maybe a gopher. They wanted a, I think if I remember rightly, they had an idea for someone called the Insider.
Oh, okay.
And who basically you'd never see him, almost like Stig from
the secret football.
Yeah, but now I did see a pilot once where this Insider turned up dressed as a sort of like, you know, dressed up or in any costume, or underneath was a journalist.
Right.
I know who it is, but I'm not going to reveal that. But when that was on the original pilot, and that didn't actually work. So I think they then sort of like, Stato sort of became invented. It was to my benefit rather than, they do a good radio show now, Andy Jacobs and Paul Hawksby. Well, Andy Jacobs was a series producer, and Paul Hawksby was working at 442 at the time. And then he came on to work on the fantasy football programme. And, you know, those two had quite a lot of say behind the scenes. I think it was an interesting programme because, you know, especially when they went live with it, it was risque to go live. It was a buzz to go live, as the Bridget Nielsen fantasy football will show. I mean, if you get a chance to watch that back on YouTube, you cannot believe that show actually aired the way it did. That was live. That was nervy, because absolutely anything could have happened in that show.
That woman is mad as a sack of cats.
Well, that was as close to... it lasted for, 10 years? It was on between 1994 and 2004. And the early part of the programme was, you know, weekly on the fantasy football and judge your teams, and you have your guest managers, and you know, that worked. I actually think that the... World Cup ones and the Euro ones were the ones that the fans really enjoyed. They enjoyed the live shows.
Yeah.
It's a big risk doing something like that live.
Can I ask you, what was the process of you getting the job? So did they contact you, or did you...
No, well, that's what happened. I was actually commentating on Tottenham against Chelsea at White Hart Lane for the... I used to do some of the club commentaries. I did a few at Tottenham, I did a few at Arsenal, did a few at Southampton, there was the Queen's Park Rangers, there was a few...
It's the Nick Barmby of club commentators.
Well, yeah, but it was quite good because I would do games that weren't covered on the TV, and, you know, if there was a TV taking it, then I wasn't required. But, you know, Arsenal and Tottenham, for example, would never play at home on the same day. So, you know, in those days, there were quite a lot of matches. And then there was other games. So, I mean, you know, this is the time when Klinsmann was playing for Tottenham, and Tottenham had a good side. And, you know, funny enough, I did quite a lot, sort of, speaking to Ian Wright about it, I must have done, Highbury was the best ground to commentate on. I remember, I mean, you talk about politically correct, this couldn't happen now, I think, but this will amuse you what happened here. We did, Arsenal played it when they had the mural.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't remember that. But after the first game...
The one that they had to repaint.
Yeah, well, I was doing the commentary on the second game, and they had to repaint it, and it started to rain that night, and all the paint went down, and unfortunate... And Ian Wright, he still records it. There was one... The ball came across, and I was sure he was going to score, and I'm to this day convinced that he's, like, looked up seen that the paint's obviously dripping off his friends in the North Bank, and completely misjudged the header.
Is it because he thought the stadium was haunted? I
don't know, but I mean, you just can't believe. I mean, well, A, I can't believe that the Islington Council complained that it wasn't a true representation of community in North London. I mean, but it was
they do have a strong point if they're saying that not every person is a professional football player.
Well, absolutely, but Highbury was a great ground to work and a great atmosphere, but Arsenal were slipping behind the times in the commercial level against other teams, and so the move was inevitable. And as moves go, I don't think you've got the atmosphere at the Emirates that you did at Highbury, but that will come. But I think it's a fantastic stadium, and the move went seamlessly, and you have to give credit to everyone who was involved in that stadium for making it so. And it's almost like the transition seems to have worked. And I hope when Spurs move, I know it's going to be an amazing stadium at Tottenham. I've been privileged enough to see some of the behind the scenes of it, and I know very well what's going on there, and I know it's going to be one of the most lavish stadiums that you'll ever see. It'll be fitted to probably host NFL as well, but that won't actually matter. I think it'll be a great atmosphere. I think you'll be much more like the Bernabeu. It'll be very, very atmospheric.
Like a cauldron.
Yeah, I think it could be the making of Tottenham.
Can I bring it back to the show and the fantasy football? What's your favourite moment from the fantasy football show?
I think picking one moment would be unfair on the others, because it's like, I think it was a concept of it. I mean, the pre-filming of those Phoenix of the Flames I thought was very clever.
Yes.
I think they did a really good job on those. And, most people, as far as I'm aware, the only person who declined was Jürgen Klinsmann. He looked at the script and he said,
"Dirty
not for me."
Jürgen.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure I'm correct on that. Well, I'm pretty sure he didn't do his, but the rest did. The spirit of which it was taken into, I think, that's how you had to view it, really.
How was Jeff Astle?
Yeah, was Jeff Astle? I was just about to ask that.
Jeff Astle was tremendous. What happened to him was incredibly sad. I mean, you knew he had some form of problem, because he would tell you a story and you'd go out for some supper, and he'd sit down and he said, "I must tell you this story. It'd be the same one he told you 5 minutes ago." Yeah. So, and how do you react to that? You can't. Now, there are some people who said that they were just taking the mickey out of him. I disagree with that. Jeff knew exactly what he was letting himself in for, and he was happy to go along with the ride.
I'm not having it that Frank would have done anything.
I mean, incredibly affectionate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that there was a school of thought that it was cruel what they did to Jeff Astle. I'm not having that. Because Jeff liked the banter. He had a fairly good sense of humour. And he was a lovely bloke. And they did take the mickey out of him, but they took the mickey out of me.
And everyone, and each other.
Yeah, but you knew where you stood with the. There wasn't a cruel factor in that.
No, it was all very good natured.
And if you hadn't stood in, I suppose I was quite lucky, because I had a bit of a dilemma as to whether to do the programme or not, because I was doing quite a lot of commentating, and if you're commentating on a serious football commentator, and I was, I'd got myself quite a nice break on it. Why did I want to then go into a role where I was being ridiculed or that? So that was probably the most interesting aspect of what I had to do.
I wanted to go into lots of detail asking you about the scoring system, but I've been told by Mike that we don't have time.
Before you do, the only person who I think has legitimate claim to have been badly treated by fantasy football was he's got a pineapple on his head. Because he took that hard. That
ruined his career.
What was he called?
Jason Lee is who you're referring to.
Nottingham Forest.
But I don't think he quite got it. But,
no.
I mean, he could have made a lot of money.
Yeah.
Putting pineapples on his head.
I got a commercial offer that he turned down that would have been a lot of money to him, and it would have been some money to me, to have it photoed of me cutting his pineapple off. Right? He declined that and went and paid for it to be done himself 2 weeks later. And then a few years later said he had no money.
Missed out.
Listen.
What was the commercial offer?
Well, it was a commercial offer that would have made him a lot of money.
We asked if any you sponsors do anywhere.
You missed the bit where he's trying to be discreet there. It was the man from Del Monte.
No, I mean, there was someone who thought it'd be funny if they had a picture of myself cutting his pineapple off and putting it in a tabloid as an advert.
Yeah. But he actually publicly stated Fantasy Football League as the reason he stopped scoring goals, didn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, if you're offered, I don't know what the sum was, but I've got a fair idea. All I know is that if you then go out and pay for it to do it yourself,
yeah,
and you can't see that it's like no one got killed. He lost his hair, so what, he can grow back.
Can I ask just to you, I don't care about the time, I've got to ask this. So yeah. When did the celebrities genuinely play the game that you gave them? And what, like you gave them a sheet and they filled it out properly?
Yeah, well, it depends, because there were different series. In the early part of the season, in the early part of the series, say 94, 95, 90, certainly 94, 95, and probably 97, 98 as well. I know they did a Euros one, but they genuinely played the game each week, because there'd been 10. What used to happen is we had an auction, so they bought the players
in the proper way.
Was no internet.
Well, no, yeah, there was no. Certainly the first two series it was played, because I can remember some of the celebrity managers, and they used to run a table each week. I think there were 10 or 12. And they then pick one or two to come in. They all think it. I don't know. I mean, the closest I can think of it of being like would be something like Strictly Come Dancing now. I mean, whereas all the players. I do remember doing one at the beginning when we had the auction.
Yeah.
And all the managers turned up to the auction. So that was a chance. And then they all bought the players. They had a set amount of money to buy. And you know, we grouped together and then see how it went. And they ran for the season. That certainly happened the first series. And I'm certain that happened the second series.
That's incredible. It was done properly.
Yeah, it was done properly. Then it went to ITV. It was a different format. The World Cup, obviously.
They
it was
tried
guest
to
managers.
Stop it being funny.
And yeah.
They got rid of the fantasy football element, didn't they? It was a bit of a shame. It became like a Soccer AM type show.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, you know, you couldn't really. I mean, in a way, you perhaps could have done it at the World Cup, but I don't think they wanted to embarrass any of the guests. The format worked.
Oh, it was a wonderful format. Game-changing.
It should be brought back, because I think, fantasy football
is
so.
It shouldn't be brought back, because without that, you can't bottle lightning. And that's the thing, is what they did was they had lightning.
Just like what's crackling through this studio every week.
In a way, I mean, you know, they
you can't
they,
repeat that success.
They had plenty of footage and they were running out, but now you could. There's so many more games covered. There's plenty of footage. I mean,
back then you were lucky to get 60 games a season.
I mean, you can still watch things. I mean, you know, like some of the clips that I found were hilarious, and they come from. You know, I helped him get all load of those Cantona clips in France when he set fire to the shirt and Auxerre, and you know. But you know, if you're watching sport all the time, you could you do see mad things.
Yeah.
Every week.
Go on, then, mate.
What
we'll do is we might do extra time where we go into the details.
Why are
of
you
the
so stern,
system.
Mike?
I used to do.
Do
my
you
own...
want to ask him? Do you want to ask Angus who his favourite drum and bass DJ is?
No, it's fine. What would you like to ask Angus? Just because I used to have to do the auction myself with the spreadsheet, kind of pre-internet, and I was just wondering. I genuinely didn't believe that they would sit down as we used to.
We had
a
full auction day. There was a proper auction where all the celebrity managers turned up. They all bid. They all knew what to do. They all played it. It was a properly done day, and then they filmed it and they used that as the first half of the first program.
Incredible.
So, and I remember the first one very well.
Fantastic. Can we ask one more?
Yeah,
question. I bet we were just going to ask you. No, two last questions. So, even I jokingly made you choose Ian Rush as your best player, which I know it would be.
Well, it's not a joke. At the time, when brought up, he was an outstanding footballer, and you'd have put him in every time.
If you talk about modern Premier League, like the latest Premier League history, who would be in your best ever team? If you were a fancy manager and you could have the choice of all of them, in fancy football terms, who would it be?
So, disregarding the budget.
Well, I think current, I mean, you've got to look now, if you're playing a fantasy football league, I think the clue to have is the players in form and the players coming. The year Suarez had for Liverpool, if you knew he was going to, that one year for Liverpool, Suarez was different class. Yeah. He was dominating. He was, I mean, now we've got, we're in a position now where there's a lot of players who are important to their teams, like Dele Alli and Kane for Tottenham are very important. Sanchez, midfield for Arsenal, very important. Ibrahimovic for Manchester United, very important. Scores plenty of goals. And you've got to, I think now, the art, I think, to the game more than ever has been fixtures, teams making shrewd changes. And, you know, like, I think that it's man management of your team. You can actually have a big say yourself as a manager by picking your team. There's never been a better time to play it because, you know, there are players who are in form, go with in form. But Suarez, that 1 year for Liverpool, I thought was the most dominant performance ever.
And do you think, will it be Harry Kane? Or
well, you don't know, because, way, I mean, or? You know, like this year, I mean, you know, Costa was explosive and Hazard's come back to form for Chelsea. City made a brilliant start. Aguero is hit and miss, but he's a lot more hit than miss. And when, you know, he's had his suspension, he might come back. City might finish the season like they started. I mean, Sanchez is an extraordinary player for Arsenal. And then you bring on Giroud at the time where he's having a key influence. It's all players in form. But I think Ibrahimovic has been a breath of fresh air for United.
Would you throw in Jermaine Defoe?
Well, yes, but you've got to remember Jermaine Defoe's playing in a side that are really struggling. Mm. I mean, you know, what he's doing for Sunderland. Yeah, Arnautovic is another one, but you'd want to be, I think, you couldn't really want to throw him in other than his price because Sunderland aren't going to win enough games, but he's going to spend plenty of money and he's going to score plenty of goals. I think you want to. This year's very different to last year. I mean, last year, Leicester were one of the great fairy tale stories of all time. This year, it's six clubs who'd expect dominating, and it's a little mini league between the six. It's what everyone thought the Premier League would always be.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that long ago. I would have said late 80s, I can remember, Arsenal led the table at this time of year. Well, the three teams chasing them, Coventry, Millwall and Norwich.
Nice.
Now,
that's look, just the that... same old faces now. I think they're talking about whether it'll be the biggest ever gap between sixth and seventh. You know, we just thought.
It will be for sure. I don't think there's any doubt about that because the gap it is now will only get bigger.
Yeah.
Those top six are, but saying that, you know, like it is cyclical. It does change. I mean, you know, the big five when the Premiership were formed, there was no Chelsea, there was no Manchester City, and that
money buys you a seat at the table.
You know, it was Everton, it was Liverpool, Everton, Tottenham, Arsenal, Manchester United. When the Premier League was formed, those were the big five.
When it became clear that Leicester were going to win the title, I actually wrote a big blog post.
Did you?
About the
I
fact
just missed
that,
it.
Yeah, yeah. Most people did. About the fact that I thought that Leeds were the last team of their type.
Blackburn.
That were going to... No, but thing is, Blackburn
that's
were...
funded.
Blackburn
money,
were expensively assembled. Leeds were a team of journeymen and a couple of big signings. And I didn't think that was ever going to happen again. Because
it was possible. I agree to an extent, but I'd probably say Nottingham Forest.
But I mean that was prior.
Yeah.
And I thought that Leeds' victory was kind of a watershed on that time. I thought that was never going to be seen again. And for Leicester to actually achieve it in this era of
Leicester didn't just win the league. They won it by 10 points.
Oh no, and brilliantly as well. Brilliantly. Mm-hmm.
Do you think they'll go down this season?
No.
I thought they'd go down last season.
Yeah, I think they'll go down this season.
So we shouldn't trust Angus's judgment on this.
On this one thing. I think they'll go down.
No, no, well, I mean, I think they could go down, but I don't think they will go down because I think there's three worse teams than Leicester.
And they didn't have Kasper Schmeichel playing for them.
Well, I just think they'd come the end of the season. I think Burnley will probably stay up, and so you've got to think all the other three...
I think buggered.
Well, no, I don't. You can't say that. He's quite well played. I thought they played pretty well at Old Trafford the other day, and they got a good result at the weekend. They could stay up. Any one of the three could stay up. Will all three stay up? No. So will two of the three go down? Probably, yes. I think there's one place.
Who would you pick? Because I'm going for Hull, Leicester, Swansea.
Oh, Swansea are doomed,
that's
I think.
My,
I think
that's my three.
Surely, Angus, well, even you, with your most optimistic hat on, Swansea are doomed.
Yeah, who would you go for?
I don't know, really. I think Swansea are going to... I mean, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Crystal Palace gets sucked into it.
No, yeah. I mean, they've had a terrible 12 months.
Zaha's currently away as well.
I mean, last year, I mean, it's a perverse thing, but, you know, Leicester could still do quite well in the Champions League, and if they were to progress, it would hinder them. They need to pick up some points, Leicester. Mm-hmm. But I think they're a better team than the others, although I did think they'd go down last season.
Yeah, I did as well, yeah, but... It was a shame because
at the beginning of the season there was I've been in Leicester today, right, and there's been a few people we were talking about it. There was an argument both ways at the beginning of the season. If you're a blind, mad, passionate fan of your team, there was a logic of why they would have a good start to last season. Right, and then because of the finish they had the season before, right? And I do know, I don't know too many who batted for the league, but I know that one or two people who had fivers on 1,000 to 1 they led by Christmas, right? And they collected $5,000 and they couldn't believe it. Now, I can understand why they had a bet like that, but to see them winning the league,
mental,
it didn't even come into my equation. Yeah. I think I would have backed nearly I didn't see them contending. I could see them making a fast start. That wasn't surprising. But then after three games, I mean, Hull made a fast start this season. Yeah. I actually thought they'd have a very similar season to what Hull had done this year. They might come out of the traps fast. They won, you know, three of the first four games. And then I thought it would implode.
It's kind of the traditional underdog season, isn't it?
Ranieri in the end was a gamble. It could have gone both ways because he was a fantastic coach in Spain. He's done it. But you've got to remember his last job, he left in humiliating fashion when Greece lost to the Faroe Islands.
But
there's no doubting he's a mercurial coach. And, you know, he goes both ways. That club had a lot of problems behind the scenes in the pre-season. It all went wrong in the pre-season.
Just talking about the people who put money on it, I like a little flutter on a little bit. What would you think of the people who cashed out even when Leicester was still quite far ahead? And I think it was only about one or two, wasn't it, who actually ended it to the season properly keeping the bet on them to win. A lot of people bottled it as they went through.
This is people who originally bet on them to win.
Yeah.
I think a lot depends on your circumstances. Because if you're a punter, you're either a punter, you're a fan, you can have life-changing money. If you had a fiver on and to win $25,000, say, right? Now, if someone offered you 15,000 and you had not enough money to afford a good holiday, or you could lose a fiver, but you could take 15,000, still be happy to see your team win, I think I'd take it.
Yeah.
If you didn't need the money, then you're not the sort of person who's had a fiver on. There are not that many. So personal circumstances, I don't see, I mean, I like a bet and I'd actually protect my stake, but if you're talking about a fiver, you'd probably take a few quid off the table and let a bit run.
It's like deal or no deal.
I'd never begrudge anyone. What I do think was is that some people took out at a bad offer.
Yeah,
there were better ways. Yeah. I mean, for example, if you had you had a tenner on at the start of the season at 5,001, right? Okay, you're going to win $50,000. Right, Leicester are now an even money chance, right? In hindsight, right? So your bet, in theory, would be $25,000 at evens. The cash out value to the bookie you offer it from was $8,000. Now, would I take that $8,000? I wouldn't, because I'd know how to try and get the $25,000.
Yeah.
You might be able to do it elsewhere. But not everyone has a mathematical brain of how to work something out. And it's very hard if someone comes up to you and say, you can have 8,000, you can have it in your bank account tomorrow.
I'll take it. I won £11.92.
Sorry, Ken. I did. I put a bet on for West Ham. Andy Carroll's score and the result. Because I was going, I thought I was going to see it. So I thought, well, I might as well make it entertaining because it'll be a 0-0 boring or 1-0. And £11.92. You can't argue with that, can you?
Lovely.
Yeah,
lovely.
Very good, yeah. On the old Paddy Power. So
certainly something I think is worth talking about because you're the only man here who has met Graeme Taylor.
Graeme? I'll tell you what, I was very fortunate that I've met Graeme Taylor many times, but then I worked with him in Euro 96. And I really enjoyed working with him because I think we were quite lucky at the time because he'd been an England manager up till 93. I think he was, I honestly believe he lost his job to a disgraceful refereeing performance. And, you know, it's been well documented in the last few days. We've seen it back again and it looks even worse when you watch it back. Not just one or two incidents, but even with the free kick that Koeman eventually scored the goal with. You know, why was it retaken? And that, I mean,
and he shouldn't have been on the pitch anyway.
So, yeah. And I know that hurt Graham a lot, but he was a total gentleman when I worked with him. He was great fun to work with, and he was a really decent human being. And he's the only, you know, like when I had my health setback, he was on the phone
really
straight away. Anything we can do for you? I've got a few contacts with football doctors. Anything we can do for you? Just let me know.
That's amazing. You only had a brief.
Well, no, I wouldn't say I only had a brief because I worked with him for Euro 96. I probably did about 30 days with him over the.
That's an intense working relationship.
No, but 30 games over the years. I wouldn't say. I mean, for the majority of Euro 96, I mean, I did quite a lot of things over Euro 96. So I did the semi-final at Old Trafford with him. And I did a few commentaries with him and I did a few things. And, you know, I used to see him around. And, you know, after that, we became, you know, he was someone who I'd quite often speak to him on the phone for advice on things.
OK.
And you know, like, you know, got to know him quite well. And probably 30, 40 days work with him, but quite a lot of other days where you could have good football banter. And he'd be the sort of person, if you went to a game, I mean... Rather, I mean, I've got a similar relationship to him as I have with David Pleat, who I think is a great guy to work with and a very underrated and knowledgeable man on, you know, football. And they love the lower leagues as well.
Yeah.
But a family man, top bloke, and I'll miss his company. I'll miss his knowledge. And I actually just think he was a victim of bad luck.
Yeah. Well, and he was England manager at a time when, let's be honest,
the pond was rather shallow.
Wasn't
no, I disagree. I don't actually. I know where you're coming from, but I don't actually agree with that because I think that England had the basis and they showed it at Euro 96 of a really good team.
Yeah,
and I mean, a few things went wrong in the Euros in 92. I mean, they were a bit unlucky. I mean, Brolin and Dahlin in that famous Sweden game. But I don't think he did too. Listen, it basically came down to the Poland games and the Holland games. And I think, you know, England played really well against Holland in the match at Wembley. They were 2-0 up. They shouldn't have not won that match. That was there for the taking. Yeah. There was a basic error. If they'd won that game, they'd have been through. They actually played very well in Rotterdam. It was a hard pill to swallow.
I remember the match.
And then the following month, of course, Galtieri scores that goal for San Marino in 9 seconds. It means nothing. He's on his way. Put it this way. If you manage England and you don't take your side to a major fight, if you fall in a qualifying, you know you're going to be sacked. Period.
Yeah.
You're not going to survive it. You can get away like Roy Hodgson did with a bad performance in the finals and retain your job. But... yeah, the press, they're ruthless, and they go for the jugular. And I mean, Martin Samuel, Alex Montgomery, there were famous headlines written in the Sun and the tabloid and the Mirror at the time. You know, going the name of Allah was one.
Well, Turnip
Taylor, if you remember the headline, it was Swedes 1, Turnips 0.
But I think that is arguably the most famous England football manager headline of all time.
I think the Swedes and the Turnips was the one. Yeah, and I mean, you know, like
And he didn't deserve that. I mean, you know, for whatever his perceived faults.
I was actually in a lift once, and a guy who worked for the paper, he'd had a few drinks, he actually asked him, are you the one that they used to call a turnip? And if I'd been Graham, I'd have wanted to whack him, but he was such a gentleman. He just turned around to him and said, well, some people in your industry decided to refer to me as that, but none of my family call me that.
Yeah.
It's a lovely way to answer that.
You're a dreadful journalist for not knowing the answer to that question.
But this guy wasn't... I mean, he just had... He said to me as we walked out the lift, he said, it's amazing what alcohol can do to your brain, isn't it? And he almost gave him the benefit of the doubt, even though he was bang out of order.
Well, I live in Watford, and so I've been past the ground a couple of times, and the display of I mean, you've got shirts going back. People have given up their prized possessions to put them out front of that ground with his name on them. It's testament to the man. He's one of the few people that I think. There are a few clubs where one person represents the club in its entirety, and Graham Taylor at Watford is one of those people.
Yeah,
and there's been a real heartfelt outpouring there. It's very, very nice to see, and I wish I'd have met him. I've met a lot of football managers in my time.
Yeah.
And he's one I would have liked to have met.
Okay. That's all we got time for.
Yeah, I think I'd say so. I was going to say, Angus, any final anecdotes about Graham Taylor? Or
give us your top 30 anecdotes.
No, I think you know, as a football man, Graham Taylor can be proud of what he achieved, and at club level, he was an outstanding manager. He had his chance at international level. It may have been one step too far for him. I don't think he can have had too many excuses for losing his job because they didn't qualify, because it's a results business. Mm. But the way we got beaten was hard, because it came down to two games against a very decent Dutch side, one in which we should have won and we lost, and we drew 2-2, and the other in which we certainly didn't deserve to lose. The way the match went, a draw would have been enough. They'd have beaten San Marino, which they did. So he knows that it's a results game. He didn't really, you know, like ever hold it against anyone. He knows. He knows if it had been someone else in his position, he'd have had to go. But then after that, he still cultivated out a very successful life. And we've seen by the reaction that people have given in the last week, he was a really decent egg, a hell of a nice man.
Angus, thank you very much for being on the show. It's been incredible. Thank you so much. Guys,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Angus.
Thank you. This has been Good Team on Paper. Thanks so much to Angus.
Stato.
And
I apologise, but yes.
He had to get a final one in.
I had to.
And we'll be back next week.